put out a book, which I'm currently reading, and it's very, very chilling reading, I have to say. You know, showing how the CIA manipulated elections in Latin America, how they manipulated the, you know, sabotage progressive governments, how they undermined them, how they tried to get governments to block off trade with Cuba and remove diplomatic recognition of Cuba and political recognition, and just really using all the kind of manipulations, like including force, including military coups, including death squads, including, you know, horrendous amounts of violence in order to basically... manipulate whole societies into towing the American line, the line of the American empire, and you know, and giving carte blanche to like multinational corporations and whatnot. You know, that was the kind of operations that that Philip Agee was a part of. You know, in his book called Inside the Company, CIA Diary, which came out in the early 70s, really documents that and was a international bestseller at the time, even though it's not exactly the easiest book to find today. But it is available on Amazon if you actually want to check it out, Inside the Company. But basically, what Philip Agee did, you know, after he left the CIA, is he basically completely changed sides. I mean, he basically became a he went to Cuba. He went to you know, he learned about socialism. He then, you know, when he lived in Western Europe, he was involved in the international peace movement. He was involved in the peace movement. He was involved in the various solidarity groups that were expressing solidarity with liberation struggles throughout the Third World, and solidarity with different anti-colonial movements, solidarity with the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, all that sort of stuff. And you know, he exposed the CIA. He exposed the agents in the CIA. He named names. He basically the reason why it is currently criminal in the United States to expose the name of a secret agent is basically because of what this guy did. He went there and he basically just named all the guys who were involved in the CIA, the kind of operations they were engaged in. And he basically, like, you know, forced the CIA to wind up a lot of its operations because they got exposed. The lights were turned on. You know, these guys were exposed for what they were doing, and they had to stop. You know, they had to back down when they were exposed. And there was a time in the 1970s in particular, like, they were really afraid of this guy who defected from the CIA and was, you know, telling the world what the CIA was really doing and the kind of, like, horrible things that they were engaged in around the world. You know, and this is the kind of, you know, Philip Agee was a brave man. He had his, the CIA really went after him. Like, he was kicked out of multiple countries in Europe. Where he tried to seek asylum. You know, they forced him out. The CIA would work with intelligence agencies in Britain and in the Netherlands and France to make sure that this guy was persona non grata, basically. And the only way he was ultimately able to live in West Germany for a long time was because he got married to a woman who had West German citizenship. And by that time, of course, his own American passport was revoked. He had to use later on a Grenadian passport, and later on a Nicaraguan passport, because of course he spent a lot of time in Nicaragua standing in solidarity with the Sandinistas and the liberation movement in Nicaragua that was fighting for the liberation of those people from a horrible U.S.-backed dictatorship during the 1980s. And, you know, like, he stood in solidarity with them. He visited that country quite a number of times as the revolutionary movement, after he gained power and was trying to build a new progressive society, you know, and eliminate the scars of colonialism from that society, you know. So Philip Agee, you know, he's very much a heroic figure, like, for those who oppose imperialism, who oppose colonialism around the world. And he's very little known today. I mean, he died in 2008 in Cuba. You know, so, but I think I'll let him basically speak for himself here. This is a talk which he gave in the early 90s at the University of Colorado, detailing the crimes of the CIA, detailing how America, the American Empire, exercises power around the world, and how it's important for people to wake up to the reality of that and resist it and fight back. So I'm gonna play this right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
sometimes it becomes necessary for the CIA to use these types of political and media operations to undermine governments. That, too, has been done from the very beginning. The CIA has overthrown democratically elected civilian governments around the world through these so-called covert action operations. All through its existence, I participated in two of these myself in South America. Some of the better known ones were in Iran in 1953, Guatemala 1954, Brazil 1964, Chile 1973, but there were many, many more besides that.
That's Philip Agee, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Philip Agee on Inside the Company, CIA Diary. In the cavernous marble and glass lobby of CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, there's an inscription etched into the wall. Not some patriotic slogan, but words from the Gospel of John. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. No matter who is president, particularly since 1945, there has been a steady stream of U.S. interventions in countries far and wide. From Grenada to Panama, and from Iraq to Afghanistan, there is no country too big or small where the United States does not declare it has an interest in. One of the key weapons in Washington's arsenal is the Central Intelligence Agency, sometimes just referred to as the agency or the company. The idea that there are rogue agents carrying out their own operations is not supported by facts. The CIA is an instrument of the White House. To talk about the CIA and its role in U.S. foreign policy is Philip Agee. Philip Agee was a former CIA officer who served in Latin America. He once wrote, "When I joined the CIA, I believed in the need for its existence. After 12 years with the agency, I finally understood how much suffering it was causing, that millions of people all over the world had been killed or had their lives destroyed by the CIA and the institutions it supports." After resigning from the agency, Agee exposed its inner workings and covert operations. For his efforts, he was denounced and vilified. His passport was revoked. Ex-CIA director and later President Bush I called Agee a traitor. Agee is the author of Inside the Company, CIA Diary, and On the Run. He passed away in 2008. This program from the AR Archives reveals patterns in U.S. foreign policy and the role of the CIA. Philip Agee spoke at Colorado State University in Fort Collins in April 1991.
Well, you know what Noriega and Saddam Hussein have in common, don't you? They are proof. They are proof that the United States no longer has to go around the world looking for enemies to attack. They prove that in recent years we have been investing heavily in their development. In both cases, you know, Noriega, very close to the CIA, the DEA, and other U.S. government agencies, and Saddam Hussein, supported to the hilt as an ally by the United States all during the Iran-Iraq War and right up to the day that he invaded Kuwait. Well, I think we can all be proud, can't we, of what we did in the Gulf. We restored the legitimate authority in Kuwait. And we restored that legitimate authority applying in Kuwait that tried and true all-American political principle of one man, one vote. In this case, one man, the emir, one vote, his. We all know the reasons why we went over there, too, don't we? As I recall, sitting in Madrid, watching it on television, seeing Bush, I get U.S. television news over there, and a lot of publications from the States. We saw Bush go on television and say that our way of life was at stake in this crisis. And after I heard Bush say that, I waited for days and then weeks for the millions of people who would take to the streets in the United States in joy, in celebration that their way of life was going to change, that their days of poverty would be over, their days of illiteracy would end, their uncared for illnesses would be taken care of. But we didn't see that. What we saw instead was George Bush His way of life, boating, golfing, and fishing on the coast of Maine, like any respectable member of the Eastern elite. Then came stopping naked aggression. We were going to prove that naked aggression would not be rewarded. Then it was a moral question. It was good versus evil, a black and white matter. And then remember James Baker, at a time when, because of the deepening economic recession here, polls were showing that people were increasingly concerned about their jobs. So Baker said one day before the television, in this Gulf crisis, jobs are at stake. And then, after all of those versions, I think Bush mainly returned to the stopping naked aggression theme, presuming, I suppose, that nobody in the United States understands that naked aggression is what's made this country what it is. You can ask any Mexican who knows his or her history, or any Native American in this country, or any Filipino who knows their history and of the savage way in which the Philippine independence movement was put down when the United States seized it as a colony in 1898. Well, there is an alternative explanation or analysis of the Gulf crisis that I would like to lay out to you tonight, offer up in a non-dogmatic way, but as a possible explanation for this Gulf crisis, which you will not find in the mainstream media. Mainstream media, as we all know, were the principal cheerleaders in the whole Bush exercise, and one of the major factors also in the violent swing in the polls of people being opposed to the war or the commencement of war, and then going up 70, 80, 90% even to approval of the way he handled the situation. Well, the alternative analysis is this, that a crisis was needed by the Bush administration and the people that they represent in the United States. Why need a crisis? In order to justify the continuation of the permanent military or permanent war economy in the United States that we have had with us since 1950. And I'll go back to that in just a moment. The official figure, some of you may know, for the proportion of the national budget that goes to military purposes was for 1990, 26%. But that figure did not include some enormous, huge military expenditures. For example, interest on the national debt from past military expenditures, the retirement programs of tens of thousands of former Department of Defense civilian employees, and many others. Analysts who factor in all these other military-related expenses come up with figures of 55 to 65% of the national or federal budget going for military. Gore Vidal, among others, puts it at around two-thirds of the national budget going for military purposes. Well, a crisis or foreign threat is needed as justification for this enormous military expenditure. What is the result of that? Domestic crises without end. We all know the litany of the domestic crises in the United States. Education, the worst educational system in the developed world. One in three illiterate, either totally or to the degree that they cannot function in a society based on the written word. One person in three not even registered to vote, that is, eligible voters not registered, one in three. And in elections, of those two-thirds who do register, only about 80% vote, meaning we have a turnout of around 50% in our national elections, a national disgrace, as a matter of fact, when you compare that with the turnout in the rest of the developed world. We elect a president in this country with 24 to 25% of the potential vote. All the other crises, the infrastructure, the environment, violence of all kinds everywhere, the problem of AIDS, finding a cure or a prevention to that disease, these domestic crises go on and on. And we're seeing them all the time, especially right now during this recession. Well, if we were to convert the U.S. economy to human purposes by cutting the military budget drastically and focusing attention on human needs, what would be the situation then? Well, in my opinion, there would be another threat. Another threat. This time, it would be a threat of democracy in the United States. We might have an informed electorate. We might have real debate of substantive issues in the political process. We might have huge numbers of people registering to vote and clamoring to get into the political process, much higher participation. We might have a situation, in fact, in which there would be a threat of a second political party in this country. These things would be a real threat to elitist control of the United States. That is, control by those few people, relatively speaking, who through private wealth and other means are the counterparts today of the people who wrote the Constitution, giving us our domestic system some 200 years ago. I'll come back to this in just a moment. But first, the permanent war economy. A conscious decision was taken, for those who don't know, in 1950 to solve internal domestic problems in the United States through militarism. During the first 4 years after World War II, four or four and a half or 5 years after World War II, the U.S. economy took a nosedive. During that period, the economy declined by 20%, and unemployment, which was practically nothing at the end of World War II in 1945, rose during the 5 years from 700,000 to 4.7 million. At the top of the Truman administration, there was extreme concern that the United States was heading back to the conditions of the Great Depression of the 1930s. A way had to be found to stop that. The principal problem was that we were not exporting enough. For 100 years, you know, we had not been able to, and still cannot, consume within the United States all that we produce. The United States economy depends on exports to sustain it. And there were not enough dollars in Western Europe to generate the sufficient quantity of imports from the United States, thus to sustain the U.S. economy. It was what people called in those days the dollar gap. Dollars had to be sent over to Europe. They were first sent over in the Marshall Plan for Reconstruction of Europe, but that did not solve the problem. In that sense, the Marshall Plan was a failure. So by 1950, at the very top level of the Truman administration, the decision was taken to solve the internal economic crisis of the United States through remilitarization of the United States and through U.S. financing of the rearmament of Western Europe. This is all contained in a document written in January 1950 by Paul Nitze, who was then the chief of the State Department's policy planning staff. It was top secret for 25 years, and only by accident in 1975 was it released and published. My copy from the Naval War College Review of 1975 is about 50 pages. It's a world analysis and also an analysis of the United States economy and the problems. The decision of the top echelon of the Truman administration was contained in this document from January 1950. One of the key phrases put it this way. This is a quote from the document. The United States and other free nations will, within a period of a few years at most, experience a decline in economic activity of serious proportions unless more positive governmental programs are developed. The solution adopted, the more positive governmental programs, was massive expansion of the military. It didn't happen automatically, though. Truman could not get this program through Congress because of the opposition in the public at large to the additional taxes that these massive increases in military spending would require. But then along came the Korean War in June of 1950. Some of you will recall that at the end of World War II, Korea, which had been occupied for 20-odd years by the Japanese, was liberated in the south by the United States and in the north by the Soviets. And the two countries split the country. They partitioned Korea, setting the boundary at the 38th parallel. The United States set up a dictatorship in the south under Syngman Rhee, and the Soviets set up a communist government in the north. For 5 years from the end of World War II and the partitioning of Korea, there were constant military clashes between the South Koreans and the North Koreans along the border area. Some of these clashes were all-out battles. Something like that occurred in late June 1950, incursions from the south to the north, which brought the north on the counterattack to the south. And the south withdrew, the north followed them south in what was equivalent to an invasion. We all called it then naked aggression, I can remember quite well. The United States immediately got emergency resolutions through the UN Security Council, as in the case of the Gulf last year, calling for the creation of an international coalition to force the North Koreans back to the 38th parallel, out of South Korea, with force if necessary. The United States immediately mobilized this coalition and sent troops very quickly to South Korea. By the end of September, the North Koreans had been pushed all the way back to the 38th parallel, and that would have been the end of the matter. That was what the resolutions in the United Nations called for, if the United States had accepted a Soviet-sponsored resolution in the UN calling for a ceasefire and countrywide elections to reunify Korea. But Truman had other ideas. He had to prolong this crisis. He had to manipulate it in order to get the leverage necessary over Congress to get this remilitarization program through. Truman, instead of stopping at the 38th parallel, sent the U.S. Army north into North Korea in an attempt, apparently, to overthrow the communist government of the North. The Chinese communists who had taken over China, defeating the U.S.-backed Kuomintang regime the year before, threatened to intervene in the Korean War if the United States did not stop its forces, because they were rushing north toward the Yalu River, which is the North Korean boundary with China. Truman did not stop the forces. Predictably, the Chinese entered the war, and hundreds of thousands of Chinese then came pouring across the Yalu River into North Korea. They stopped the U.S. advance. In fact, they forced the United States to retreat. By November 1950, the U.S. media, newspapers and radio and what television there were full of stories and pictures of U.S. soldiers retreating through ice and snow before these advancing hordes of communist Chinese troops. It was then that Truman was able to seize the emotional moment and go on national television. He declared a state of national emergency and said what Bush's remarks about our way of life being at stake reminded me of. Truman mustered all the hype and emotion he could, and he said, "Our homes, our nation, all the things that we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union." He also called again in the same speech for massive increases in military spending for U.S. and European forces, apart from the needs in the Korean War. Well, of course, there was no threat at all from the Soviet Union at the time. They were still digging themselves out of the rubble of World War II, when they had lost 20 million people. But a crisis, a foreign threat, was needed to justify this program, and so Truman and his administration began to manufacture the Soviet crisis. They were helped along through the U.S. media, of course, and early on then, the Soviets became the international threat, the grave threat to the security of the United States that they were all through the years up until just recently. Truman finally did, through his manipulation of the Korean War, he did get the leverage over Congress, and he got approval for this remilitarization program. During the first 2 years of this program, military spending more than tripled, from $13 billion in 1950 to $44 billion in 1952. And during the same 2 years, the military forces in the United States doubled to 3.6 million people. From that time on, the permanent war economy was a reality, leading up to the situation we have today, which I already mentioned, with two-thirds of the national budget or so going for military purposes. During that long so-called Cold War period, the CIA was a very important instrument in waging the war. Very important. It was established in 1947 with the National Security Act, which also set up the National Security Council as the top policy-making body in matters of national security and foreign affairs. According to the law, the National Security Act of 1947, which is still in effect today, the National Security Council is chaired by the President of the United States and has as statutory members the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and several others at that very top level. These are the people who make the foreign policy of the United States. They are the ones who determine what the CIA is going to do. Keep in mind that the CIA doesn't have a policy of its own. It is an instrument of the President. And if anyone objects to what the National Intelligence Service does, the CIA, then the argument really is with the president of the day and not with the agency itself. Well, the purpose of the CIA, of course, was to collect information all around the world, process the information, and present it to the policymakers like the president for their decisions. And the CIA was doing that from the very beginning. I should say right here that I believe the United States needs an intelligence service. But from the very beginning, the CIA was used to do a lot more than simply collect information and give it to the president and other policymakers. At the very first meeting of the National Security Council in October 1947, this is the month after Truman signs the National Security Act into law, the first meeting of the NSC with Truman in the chair, the decision is taken to set aside $10 million for the CIA to intervene secretly in the upcoming Italian elections, scheduled for April 1948. That $10 million was because the United States was afraid that a left-wing coalition known as the Popular Bloc would win the elections. The coalition was made up of communists and socialists and other left-wing parties, and these parties had been the backbone of the resistance to fascism, to more than 20 years of fascism in Italy. These parties, socialists, communists, and others on the left, had come out of World War II, out of the fascist period, in a very prestigious and strong position. On the other hand, the CIA's money was going to the Christian Democrats, the conservatives. The money was passed out through front organizations in Italy, through Italian-American organizations in this country, and through the Vatican. And it was successful. When the elections were held in April 1948, the Christian Democrats won going away. That was not, however, the beginning and the end of the CIA's support of the Christian Democrats. During the next 25 years, the CIA subsidized the Italian Christian Democrats in more than $100 million. As late as 1976, President Ford approved a $6 million subsidy program for the Christian Democrats in elections coming up in June of that year, 1976. And the Christian Democrats, of course, have used that money to stay in power all these years. They have dominated every single government in Italy, and there are now 50 of them since those elections in 1948. And that CIA money, of course, helped them stay in power. Well, the CIA was also doing a lot of other things besides trying to help out its friends in politics. It was doing this, by the way, not just in Italy, but soon all over the world. One of the things that I was doing in the CIA was giving money to politicians and political parties. I remember one strange party in Ecuador that a colleague of mine founded. He actually founded a political party through Ecuadorian political leaders, and it was a reformist party. He wanted it to appeal to as wide a following as possible, and so he gave it an unusual name. He called it the Popular Revolutionary Liberal Party. Well, the trade union field was wide open for the CIA. From the very beginning in the late 1940s, the CIA was working in the trade union field. We set up unions. We trained people in trade unionism. We manipulated unions. We established a vast international network of unions. I could speak of trade unions on trade unions and the CIA all night long. What was behind this was the belief in the United States that the working class movement, as in the United States, cannot be trusted anywhere. They have to be co-opted and brought under control, in this case, clandestine control by the CIA. Youth and student movements also. For youth movements, we were very active. We had an international worldwide youth organization. Every time there were student elections in the universities, we had our candidates running and we were giving them money for their election. Media was another field. Vast operations in the media. And media operations generally are when the CIA pays a foreign journalist to publish or use the CIA's material as if it were the journalist's own. The officer in charge of media operations is constantly giving editorial guidance and direction to the writers who publish in the media influenced or controlled by the CIA. And I'm talking about newspapers, magazines of all sorts, learned journals, scholarly journals, academic journals, every type of publication, and not just print, television, radio, even cinema. these operations, too, went all around the world and have existed all through these 44 years of the CIA's existence. Sometimes it becomes necessary for the CIA to use these types of political and media operations to undermine governments. That, too, has been done from the very beginning. The CIA has overthrown democratically elected civilian governments around the world through these so-called covert action operations. All through its existence, I participated in two of these myself in South America. Some of the better known ones were in Iran in 1953, Guatemala 1954, Brazil 1964, Chile 1973. But there were many, many more besides that. Another area of CIA operations which you should know about are liaison operations. Liaison operations are all those activities undertaken by the CIA jointly with the intelligence and security services of foreign countries. These started at the very beginning also. The British were the main liaison service at the very beginning because they had trained and established, really, the CIA's predecessor intelligence organization during World War II, which was known as the Office of Strategic Services. But early on, the CIA began establishing new services which they could then train and guide and control. One of the first places was in Greece. Following the Greek Civil War from 47 to 1949, in which the United States intervened on the side of the extreme right in Greece, which won that civil war, in the wake of that war, the CIA established an internal security service called the KYP, or KEEP. KYP being the Greek letters for CIA. They gave it the same name. This was the service that for 20 years was used as an instrument to keep the far right in power in Greece. In 1967, when that power was threatened through upcoming elections, the CIA and the KYP organized a military coup, which brought 7 years of military dictatorship of a neo-fascist stripe to Greece. It was the so-called Colonel's regime. The very first president of the Greek military junta, set up in 1967, was a colonel named George Papadopoulos. And he, until that moment, had been the chief liaison officer of the KYP with the CIA office in the U.S. Embassy in Athens. Iran is another example. In 1953, the CIA undermined the democratically elected civilian government at that time, fomented or provoked a military coup against that government, and installed the Shah of Iran as virtual military dictator. In the wake of that operation, the CIA established a service, internal security service, like the KYP in Greece, but in Iran they called it the SAVAK. The SAVAK was the principal instrument through which the Shah held power for 25 years. It became famous the world over for its torture chambers and its assassinations of the Shah's political opponents. And of course, it was supported, just like the KYP, all through the years by the CIA in every possible way. I remember, after the fall of the Shah, very well, film footage from Dutch television showing a SAVAK torture center in Tehran. It consisted of a dirt floor. It was in the basement of a building, and it had steel beds, which had tiers, four or five tiers of steel mesh. The torturers would make a coal fire on the ground underneath the bed. And the person to be interrogated and tortured would be started on the top tier and then moved gradually down as he was questioned, or he or she was questioned. And eventually the person, of course, was murdered or killed by being barbecued alive. This was one example of what the SAVAK did.
You're listening to Philip Agee on Inside the Company, CIA Diary. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Or on Guatemala had the most liberal and progressive government in Latin America. They had a number of very positive programs going. They were not communist by any means, they were not socialist by any means, but they were liberal, democratic reform programs that they had installed to try to modernize that country, especially in education. But then in 1953, along came a land reform program that affected landholdings of the United Fruit Company in Boston. And it happened that the law firm of the United Fruit Company was the New York Wall Street firm known as Sullivan and Cromwell. This law firm numbered among its partners, senior partners, Allen Dulles, who was then director of the CIA, and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was then the Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration. The two Dulles brothers, on behalf of United Fruit, brought the CIA into the picture through operations to undermine the democratically elected civilian government. They did so to the point that they provoked a military takeover, and that was the last day of democracy that Guatemala has seen since then. There have, from time to time, been figurehead presidents, civilian presidents. But in Guatemala, ever since that operation in 1954, the military have really run the country. And in the aftermath, as in Iran the year before, the CIA started setting up an internal security service. And that, plus other services that they have established, then spawned the death squads that became so famous in Guatemala. And it meant that the CIA was directly connected with support to those death squads all through the years. No one knows how many people have been murdered and killed by these death squads and security services supported by the CIA in Guatemala. Some people say 100,000, some people say 125,000, some say 150,000. Nobody will ever know for sure how many people have been tortured to death or assassinated by these death squads. They are, just as in El Salvador during the last 10 years, they are aspiring leaders of the student movement, of the trade union movement, activists in the field of human rights, those kinds of people who are picked up and murdered outright. In El Salvador, you can be as sure as you are of your own name that for the last 10 years, the CIA has been working hand in glove with the security services and the death squads in El Salvador that have by now wiped out some 75,000 people in these 10 or 11 years. Coming back to the Gulf and this crisis in the Gulf, I said before that I thought it was a crisis that the United States provoked. Not only that the United States needed, that is, that the Bush administration needed. There are many signs that this was a crisis that was wanted, that the Bush administration policy was to make Saddam Hussein believe that he could take over Kuwait with impunity. The Bush administration knew perfectly well the historical Iraqi claims on the Kuwait. They knew perfectly well that Kuwait had belonged to the southern province of Iraq, that is the Basra province, for several hundred years before, during the Turkish-Ottoman occupation of that area. But with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, the French and the British moved into that area, the French mainly into Lebanon and Syria, and the British into the Persian Gulf. The Bush administration knew perfectly well that in 1922, Sir Percy Cox, the British High Commissioner in Baghdad, drew for the first line in history lines in the sand delineating borders, national borders between what are now Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. And he drew those lines lopping off Kuwait from Iraq precisely and deliberately to deprive Iraq of a proper seaport on the Persian Gulf. The British wanted no competition to their dominance of the Persian Gulf from Baghdad, which was at that time the cultural and commercial center of the region. The British at the same time converted no less than 10 sheikhdoms into colonies, including Kuwait. Well, the Iraqis, all through the years, continued to insist on their claims to Kuwait. They did this in different ways. In 1962, they did recognize Kuwaiti independence, but the movement for reunion between Iraq and Kuwait, historically speaking, continued. In 1961, when the British gave Kuwait independence, the Iraqis massed troops along the Kuwait border, threatening to take the territory back by force. The British rushed a military force to Kuwait, and the Iraqis backed down. The Iraqis repeated this threat in 1972 and 1976. All of this history is known perfectly well by the Bush administration. Schwarzkopf has already said on television what a lot of people knew much earlier on, or who suspected much earlier on, and that is that U.S. planning for this crisis in the Persian Gulf and for the war started long before. In Schwarzkopf's words, 18 months of planning before. Others have put it at about 2 years before the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq. There were more immediate grievances on the part of Iraq against Kuwait. In 1986, the OPEC ministers, petroleum ministers, had set a price of $18 per barrel, and they had set quotas for all the OPEC members, quotas, production quotas, to maintain that price of $18. But the Kuwaitis for several years had been overproducing so much that it had driven the price down. Last June it was down to $12 or $13, which was the best price that industrialized importing nations like the United States had gotten in more than 40 years in constant dollars. It was undermining drastically the Iraqi economy, this overproduction by Kuwait and by the United Arab Emirates. In addition to that, there was a question of theft. While Iraq was occupied with Iran during the eight-year war, the Kuwaitis began drilling from the Rumaila oil field, which is an immense oil deposit, which is almost all in Iraq. A very small part dips into a disputed territory or border area between Iraq and Kuwait. And Iraq was insisting, demanding that Kuwait pay for the oil they had taken out during those years. Another matter was the question of loans. Kuwait, or let's say Iraq, was saddled with an $80 to $90 billion debt after its war with Iran. Much of this money was owed to Kuwait, and the Iraqis were insisting that the Kuwaitis forgive those loans because the Iraqis, in fact, had stopped the spread of Islamic fundamentalism into the Arabic countries of the Persian Gulf. There were all these grievances that Iraq had, and Kuwait was taking a hard line. In mid-July, the OPEC oil ministers met in Geneva, and at that very time, Iraq massed 30,000 troops on the border with Kuwait to pressure Kuwait into accepting new quotas and a new price, and they were successful. OPEC and the Kuwaitis were in agreement, set a new price of $21 per barrel, and new quotas to maintain that price, new production quotas. In the days afterwards, however, Hussein, instead of withdrawing those 30,000 troops from the Kuwaiti border, he more than tripled them to 100,000. And that was the situation on April 25th when the U.S. Ambassador, April Glaspie, met with Hussein face to face. The Iraqis secretly recorded this meeting, later made public a transcript of the conversation, a transcript which was not disputed at all by the Department of State. Recently, they've been trying to rewrite it, but they didn't dispute it in the least. In fact, in October, Margaret Tuckweiler, the spokesperson of the State Department, said that it was essentially accurate. This U.S. Ambassador, April Glaspie, told Hussein in that meeting, "Mr. President, I have a direct instruction from Secretary of State Baker to emphasize to you that the United States has no opinion," that's the operative quote, "no opinion on your disputes, your border disputes with Kuwait." She also said that she had an instruction from President Bush to seek better relations with Iraq. With 100,000 troops, Iraqi troops on the Kuwait border threatening to invade, not one word from the U.S. ambassador of warning not to. On the contrary, the United States had been doing other things, just the opposite, in the months prior to the invasion. In April, for example, the Assistant Secretary of State, John Kelly, he's the Assistant Secretary for Middle Eastern Affairs, he testified before the Congress that the United States had, quote unquote, no commitment to defend Kuwait. He also made this very same testimony before Congress 2 days before the invasion. On the day of the ambassador's meeting with Hussein, that same Assistant Secretary of State canceled a planned Voice of America broadcast that would have stated that the United States would not tolerate aggression in the Gulf and that we would come to our friends, including to the defense of our friends, including Kuwait. That was canceled. And the prohibition went out that no warning could be made to any of the thousands of people who might become hostages if there was an invasion. According to Senator Boren, who is the chairperson of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the CIA was predicting the invasion of Kuwait 6 days or so before it actually happened. This has also come out in other reports. There was a whole week when Bush could have taken action to completely avoid the crisis. He could, for example, have called for an emergency sessions of the UN Security Council to get resolutions through that would have showed Hussein that the international community would not tolerate an invasion of Kuwait. He could have, like the British did before, rushed a multinational military force to Kuwait. He could have issued a public warning. There were many things which could have been done. But if you review Bush's activities and the press during that last week between the ambassador's meeting with Hussein and the invasion itself, You will find that the Bush administration took no action at all. On the contrary, as I mentioned, the Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East testified before Congress 2 days before the invasion that the United States had no commitment to defend Kuwait. Put all that together, and I think it's reasonable to conclude that the Bush administration policy was to encourage Saddam Hussein to think that he could take over Kuwait with impunity, thereby sparking this international crisis, a crisis that can be prolonged for many years if the Bush administration plays it right. Well, what we did in the Gulf is pretty clear, isn't it? For many years, 40 years at least, we have been exporting in quantities worth billions of dollars war-making material. Ships, planes, tanks, weapons of every sort. In this case, there is a new policy. We have not only exported all of that equipment, but we've exported also the people to operate it. We did, in fact, send the U.S. armed forces abroad in this Gulf crisis like one more export, and it is going to be quite profitable. Consider the fact that the United States has a national debt of $3.5 trillion, $800 billion of which is owned by foreigners. In my opinion, it was only a matter of time before, in order to help manage this crisis, that the United States would send the armed forces abroad like one more export. And it's going to be profitable because about 3 weeks ago, the Congressional Budget Office announced their analysis, or they published their analysis, on the cost of the war. It came to $40 billion. The very same day, Fitzwater in the White House, a few hours later, says, no, we don't accept that $40 billion figure. We have pledges of $55 billion, and we're going to make sure that every penny is paid. It doesn't take an accountant to understand that there is going to be a huge profit on this war, perhaps as much as $15 billion. What we did over there, of course, is what we do best nowadays, and that is to make war. And in doing so, you know, we could not finance it ourselves. The United States cannot finance a foreign war like that anymore. But in this case, the United States' war-making capacity, what we do best, was financed by the people who make things that people want all around the world. VCRs, cars. In other words, it was the Japanese mainly and the Germans who financed the war. And now we are sitting astride in a very powerful position, their sources of energy. So much for the Gulf crisis and for the CIA, historically speaking. I don't think it's enough simply to describe these things or to analyze them. There is one more thing that ought to be done, and that is to ask a question. The question, why we as a nation or as a society do these things abroad, these grisly things like the CIA support to the institutionalization of torture in country after country, or their work in support with the death squads of countries like Guatemala and El Salvador and many others, or the overthrow of democratically elected civilian governments, their replacement with fascist military dictatorships. Why do we do this abroad? Why do we, for example, in this Persian Gulf crisis, slaughter between 100,000 and 200,000 Iraqis? You saw the television pictures, I'm sure, just like I did, of all the bodies on the highway going north. Those people who had thrown down their weapons were simply trying to get out of there, escaping. They were slaughtered by the thousands. And nobody knows how many were killed. It's somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. Well, when I was a trainee in the CIA, I was taught, that the Soviet Union's foreign policy, its belligerence and its expansionism abroad, was a direct product of its domestic system. That is, the requirements of the Soviet Communist Party to maintain a monopoly on power in that country. And I think any country's foreign policy, any political scientist would agree, is a direct product of the domestic system in whichever country we're speaking of. So in order to answer the question of why we do these things abroad, I think we have to come back and look at the domestic system in the United States. When I came back to the States for the first time in so many years without a visit, it was 1987, and you remember what we were doing, don't you? We were celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Constitution of the United States. You remember all those celebrations? Well, they reminded me of a passage in Noam Chomsky's terrific book about Central America called Turning the Tide. In that book, he discusses the Constitutional Convention of 1787. I mention this because, after all, the Constitution are the rules of the game, isn't it, for the domestic system in the United States. That's where our domestic system comes from. It's in the Constitution. And in discussing the Constitutional Convention, Chomsky, of course, pointed out that those 55 men meeting in Philadelphia that summer, in total secrecy, not one word of what was said at the Constitutional Convention came out until after more than 50 years had passed. They made it completely in secret. Those 55 men met there to search for resolutions to problems in governing under the Articles of Confederation. And in writing a new constitution, they did what was equivalent to a coup d'etat against the previous government. But the question arose at the Constitutional Convention early on. The question arose, who really is to govern the United States? And John Jay had the answer. You'll remember John Jay as the president of the Continental Congress that had fought the war for independence from Britain. And he was also the first Chief Justice of the United States, of the Supreme Court. John Jay had the answer. He said, well, of course, the people who own the United States ought to govern it. And so the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution along that line. In doing so, they wrote completely out of the political process 95% of the population of these United States at that time. They eliminated completely from the political process all the indentured laborers, all the men without property, all the Native Americans, they were considered savages, all of the African Americans, they were slaves, most of them, and of course half the population, all the women. Who were they? They were the elite of colonial society. They represented the bankers, the merchants, the lawyers, the landowners, the slaveholders, etc. And they wrote the Constitution very clearly to preserve and enhance their private wealth and the power that went with it. Nevertheless, they had the gall to start the Constitution with the words, we the people of the United States, as if the other 95% weren't people. Well, I mention this not to put down the Constitution totally. The Bill of Rights is certainly something extremely important, the most important part of the Constitution, and we have to fight as much as we can to defend it. But that is where our domestic system comes from, and despite 200 years of legislation and 20-odd amendments, we are still operating under the same rules of the game today as they were 200 years ago. The same rules of the game. It is the root or the source of the situation in which when we go out and vote today and are selecting between Republicans and Democrats, we're really only choosing between, on the one hand, Tweedledum, and on the other, Tweedledee, because they speak of one voice, the two parties. That also comes from the Constitution. It was the original pact between the political forces in the United States to keep the political debate as narrow as possible and to make the rules of the game as hard as possible to change. My position is that until we have fundamental change in this country, we will continue to have these activities abroad, including these horrible things that the CIA does abroad, including the terrible human cost of armed military interventions as occurred just now in Iraq. They are going to continue because they are in the interest of the very few people who really run the United States, those few people who are the counterparts to the colonial elites who wrote the Constitution. That's where the problem lies. It lies in fundamental domestic change in the United States. It lies in achieving a real democratic process in this country. And that, of course, can be done if this economy could be converted to human purposes. But there will be an enormous struggle to stop it. But one thing that you really have to do is continue also the solidarity movement. And mind you, that anybody who knows the history of these last 40 or 45 years knows that this Gulf crisis is not the last. It is only the most recent. And that right around the corner is another crisis because of all of those reasons I mentioned before concerning the military budget and justification. Finally, there is the matter of study. Matter of study, very important activity. I know personally that no one can stay an activist and stay in the struggle over the long haul without constant renovation, constant renewal of the ideological and the intellectual basis upon which our actions are taken. And there are wonderful publications out today. These media analysis publications on the table, Lies of Our Times and Extra, and Noam Chomsky's book, Necessary Illusions, those are some of the best ways in which a person can understand thought control and censorship in the United States, even though we are taught to believe that we have a free press. We don't have it at all. As was said a long time ago, the only person who has freedom of the press is the man who owns one. But when we talk about books, we have to be very careful. You should never forget what Congressman Harold Velde said in the House of Representatives. It was a speech that he made in the early 1950s when I was a university student. Congressman Velde of Illinois was speaking, get this, in opposition to the Mobile Public Library Service for Rural America. In his speech, among other things, he said, educating Americans through the library service could bring about a change of their political attitude quicker than any other method. The basis of communism and socialistic influence is education of the people. You can find that in the congressional record. Finally, there is the CIA off-campus movement. Someone told me that they were here just weeks ago and that nothing happened practically. There was almost no opposition. Well, there is opposition to their recruiting on campuses all across the United States. And it's worthy, too, because there is no justification for Murder Incorporated coming on the campuses of universities in the United States and recruiting young people into that activity. Well, final comments on what to do. My suggestion is not to be discouraged because this war went on. Not be discouraged, even though hundreds of thousands of people were marching. That is, those among you who opposed that war. Disappointed, yes, but not discouraged. We have to be realistic. We have to understand that we live still in an age of imperialism, that we are part of the imperialist country in the world with enormous, enormous power. But at the same time, to understand that every little grain of sand that we put in this struggle to stop imperialism, to change the domestic system in the United States, is worth it, and that we're out there doing those kinds of things simply because we believe in them, because we know that they are right and proper and worthy in themselves, regardless of the outcome at any one particular time. Thank you all very much.
That was Philip Agee on Inside the Company, CIA Diary. This program from the AR Archives was recorded at Colorado State University in Fort Collins in April 1991. Philip Agee was a former Central Intelligence Agency officer who served in Latin America. After he left the agency, he exposed its inner workings and covert operations. He's the author of Inside the Company, CIA Diary. Philip Agee died in 2008. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly.
We are Paisley Road Public School with our grade 4 class.
And you're listening to CMRU.
If you had the opportunity to save a life, would you take it? Sounds like a no-brainer, right? And yet only 31% of people in Ontario have registered their consent to donate their organs and tissue in the event of their death. That means, on average, one person will die every 3 days because an organ is not available to save them. By registering, you have the opportunity to save as many as 8 people's lives through organ donation and to improve the quality of life for up to 75 people through tissue donation. If you want to become a donor, go to beadonor.ca. Take 2 minutes to register your consent to save a life. And don't forget to share your wishes with your family afterwards. In the words of Mike Willis, a very grateful heart recipient,
"If someone hadn't registered their consent to donate, I would not be alive today."
Tune in Wednesdays 9 to 11 a.m. for The Stillness and the Dancing, a quiet corner of ambient, drone, modern classical, and experimental beauty. If you're looking to find some solace in a chaotic world, there's no better show to stay in bed for. That's The Stillness and the Dancing every Wednesday morning, 9 to 11 a.m. here on CFRU 93.3 in Guelph.